Well, in 1729, the English writer Jonathan Swift, the author of Gulliver's Travels, wrote a pamphlet called A Modest Proposal. And I read this when I was studying English Lit at the University of Melbourne back in the day. And look, it's one of those pieces you just never forget. Swift proposed that impoverished Irish families could ease their economic woes by selling their babies to the rich, sell them for food. He even provided some tasty recipes for the preparation and the cooking of these babies before they were served up as a feast. And I guess that when you first read it, you'd think this is a sicko kind of idea, a very distasteful idea indeed. But you soon realise that the pamphlet is a satire, a kind of black satire, and it takes the cruelties, the absurdities of the world that Swift knew, and to which perhaps respectable folks had been dulled, and it makes them, well, it makes them new and raw and unsettling. I suspect that the latest book from the brilliant and dystopian American writer Jesse Ball is also, in its own way, a modest proposal. It's called A Cure for Suicide.
"This is a chair," said the examiner. "A person is made in such a way that he can sit where he likes. He can sit on the ground," she knelt and patted the floor, "or even on the table itself," she patted the table. "However, if you are in company, it is best to sit in a chair, unless there is a good reason to sit elsewhere. In a chair one can sit with good posture, that is, with the skeleton set into good order." He looked at her with puzzlement. "The skeleton," she said, "is a hard substance, hard like wood, like the wood of this chair. It is all through the inside of your body and mine. It keeps us stiff and allows our muscles something to pull and push on. That is how we move. Muscles are the way the body obeys the mind. Here," she said, "come sit in the chair." She gestured. The claimant came across the room slowly. He moved to sit in the chair and then sat in it. He felt very good sitting in the chair. Immediately he understood why the house was full of chairs. "They put chairs wherever someone might sit." "They do," she said. "And if your needs change, you can move chairs from place to place. Come, let us eat. We shall walk to the kitchen, and there we will get the things we shall eat. Also, we will get the things on which we shall eat, and the things with which we shall eat. We will not eat our food there. We'll go to the dining room or to the enclosed porch. This will be a nice thing for us. Having gotten the food and the implements, we will decide whether we want to eat on the porch or in the dining room. Do you know how we will decide that?" The claimant shook his head. "You do. Think carefully. Say what comes to mind." "If it is a nice day outside?" "That is one reason, one of many reasons why a person would choose to sit outside. It is a good reason. It's always best to have a good reason for doing things, a reason that can be explained to others if you must. One should not live in fear of explaining oneself, but a rational person is capable of explaining, and even sometimes likes to do so." "Rational?" "A person whose life is lived on the basis of understanding rather than ignorance."
Nicely read. Thank you, Jesse. Jesse, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Michael.
So where are we when the story opens, when this conversation takes place?
A man has lost his memory and he is being given the tools with which to live a life in a sort of gentlest village.
Yes, it's called The Gentlest Village, and as the reader, I work out pretty quickly, I think, that we're in some sort of treatment centre, some sort of convalescent hospital. I don't know whether it's a small place. It feels as though it might be vast. And I also know the man is called The Claimant, and the woman is an examiner. And she says early on in this conversation that her name will be Teresa. It's not her real name, but she explains that that's the name they will use, and he will be Anders. That's not his real name, but that's the name they will use. So there's some interest quite early on in their relationship in the power of naming things and people. What's driving that interest for you, that aspect of the story? What's driving it?
I think names, and we have nothing else. At first, names are a way of gaining some traction in a situation and then beginning to establish a structure. Then once we have that structure, we can move outward to assigning meaning to more things. Names also, amongst people, are ways of constructing allegiances and gaining comfort.
And that all sounds very benign, but somewhere in the first 70 pages or so, as a reader, we become unsettled because this may be more menacing than therapeutic. You begin to wonder. In fact, this examiner herself has a little thought. She says, if the news was to be believed, the process of villages was growing all the time. Soon it would be everywhere. And that's quite an important moment in the story because it signals to us that this, well, that this could be some, what's the term, that this is some sort of big brother process, perhaps, for annihilating the individual rather than rescuing the individual. We start to wonder about that.
When I first had the idea for this story, it seemed very obvious that it could be done in a way in which this process of giving people back their lives, but blunting them at the same time, it seemed obvious that it could be shown to be malevolent, that the mechanism that's operating on these people could be a malevolent one. But I thought that would be too easy. So I think in writing the book, I tried to make it that no one is assigned a villainous role, per se, but each person who is operating is perhaps attempting to be kind. I think the worst things are often done by people with good intentions.
And I think the reason that we feel uneasy about this, that the reader feels uneasy about this, is because the book looks as though it belongs in company with Brave New World, the Aldous Huxley book, or with Orwell's 1984, or even with that Peter Weir film, The Truman Show, you know, maybe even Kafka, although in Kafka everybody's distressed. But as you say, it's got those resonances. But as you say, the people who are involved in it seem to be calm and resigned. I suppose what I'm asking you is, are those books that I've listed, Brave New World, 1984, perhaps The Truman Show, are those the kinds of books that you're keeping company with?
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. I think there's a great danger for human beings, particularly, in obtaining what it is that we want. So we strive to gain greater and greater control over ourselves, over the world, over society. And I think it may not necessarily always be positive. In fact, quite the contrary. We may be moving more and more towards a duller, more lifeless place. I think that's why it's good for there to be cataclysms and catastrophes to wrench us away from achieving our specific ends.
What kind of catastrophe would be good? What do you mean? I mean, I can't imagine a catastrophe being a good thing. What have you got in mind?
Well, I mean, to be extremely specific, one thing is that politically, you end up with a small group of people controlling the mass of people. So I think when there are catastrophes that wrench political control away from really any group that has it, it is always going to be good.
You mean a catastrophe in the sense of a social upheaval or an uprising of the people themselves?
It can be that, or it can be some kind of physical upheaval which brings the sleeping giant out of its sleep. You know, I think there's even, holidays, it's easy to think that holidays are really nice, everyone likes a holiday, but often they end up, I guess, using up the nervous energy that is building amongst people. And so then instead of having that energy build into an explosion, which improves the general condition, it just is all spent on, Christmas happiness and reveling and such.
So, Jesse, in the world you've created, there is no rebellion. There may be the occasional flicker of doubt, but there's no rebel underground that you might get in a science fiction story. There's no defiant humanity. There's no Winston Smith bucking against the system.
No, they're far beyond that, unfortunately.
So you've called this a cure for suicide, which is what made me think that it might be a Swift style of modest proposal. Do you want to just explain the title or talk to the title a little?
The original idea that I had for the book was, what if in the future someone came upon a sort of injection that would remove memory but leave a person capable of continuing to live? And what if there were such a thing as a department of failure that a person who wanted to commit suicide could go to, and then having gone to it, they could receive an injection and essentially begin again? So that's the sort of initial idea that I had. It led to a notion that maybe then this person could be weaned back into life in a pleasurable and gentle and kind surroundings. So what would that be? Well, an instant idea was something bucolic, you know, some archetypal village. So then that became this idea of the gentlest village. But of course, if we just begin it this way, where someone has a life that leads to catastrophe and then their memory being taken away, it's, I don't know, maybe it all seems too inevitable and there might not be enough tension. So the way the book is constructed, you begin with a person who has woken up and their memory is gone. And then they go through the process. And then about halfway through the book, you get the second half, which is the life that preceded the tragedy.
Yeah, so the point is that this treatment might be seen as a cure for suicide. I must say, Jesse, here at RN, we're very tuned into the message from medical health professionals that we should avoid talking carelessly about suicide because there's always people in your audience who will be in the grip of dark or suicidal thoughts. Were you thinking seriously about suicide when you were writing this book, or is it a kind of premise for your philosophical excursion?
I guess in a way it's always, it's always complicated whether a thing is metaphorical or specific, whether events that take place in a book are real or not. They are always, to some extent, a imagined construction. But regarding suicide, I think I understand that there are people who are on the edge, and I understand that it's something that people want to take very seriously. It's always a tragedy for families when someone commits suicide. But I would say the greater danger is actually this enormous medical complex that desires the blunting of real existence and that perpetrates that agenda through the expenditure of massive monies and the interwoven with governmental powers, the creation of situations that essentially force people into being so medicated they can barely feel. So it would be, this would be a backdrop for the world in which we live and that which prompted the creation of this metaphor, a cure for suicide.
On RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and my guest is the American writer Jesse Ball, and we're talking about his new dystopian novel, which is called A Cure for Suicide. Jesse, have you been up close yourself to someone who's been in an institutional setting and who's received treatment that you felt has dulled them to life? Is there a first-hand experience that's helped to trigger this story?
I would hesitate to say that there was any sort of one-to-one thing, but I certainly have known many people who have been pushed in one direction or another by medications. Sometimes the medications are very helpful and can seem to rescue people's lives, but everything to do with existence is, it's difficult to make any conclusive statements about it. For instance, a life where you live without very much panache and daring and vivacity, you live such a life for 80 years, how can that be compared to 10 vivid, resplendent, explosive years lived at the edge of your body? It's very difficult to compare these things. And so if someone says, even in terms of suicide, that a person should certainly not commit suicide, it's a complicated question. I mean, some of it goes back to Roman ideas of property, that the body is property and is of value in and of itself. But if the body is not of value to you, then who is it of value to? It's complicated. I don't think there's any simple answers.
Jesse, you write very clear prose, wonderfully clear prose. And you often hear writers and academics claim that complex ideas require complex language. But I think you've written a very complex book that's instantly accessible. It just flows into you. How do you respond to that view that you need complex language to get into philosophical complexity?
Well, it's awfully kind of you to say such things, and I shouldn't allow you to. But
it's my show. I'll say what I like.
But I think the better someone understands something, the more simply they can speak. So it's always best in discussion to use the simplest possible language. And I think a good example is the game Go, or it's in Korea, it's baduk. It's a game of stones. It's played on a 19 by 19 board. Do you know this game?
I do.
And so there are many games, and many games have extremely complicated rules, long, laborious rule sets that you have to memorize. It's very difficult to even begin to play such games. But you can memorize all the rules and then begin. But then the gameplay is fairly fatuous. Maybe over the course of an afternoon, you realize that there's just a few strategies and it's very easy to, you know, implement them. However, Go is one of the simplest games in terms of learning how to play it. A stone, if it's enclosed on four sides, is eliminated. And everything else just flows from this very simple proposition. So I think simplicity is, as you say, the foremost means of obtaining beautiful intricacy. Because in simplicity, you construct basic elements that will have extremely long and lovely ramifications. Whereas if everything begins in a sort of, shabby, tedious complexity, then, you know, the stone won't skip very far out onto the lake. It will sink after a skip or two.
I read this book in two grabs, Jesse. I could easily have read it in one, actually. I think it would take, well, I'm not sure, 3-4 hours maybe to read. So you do write short books as I look over your work. I gather that you think it is important to write a book that can be read briefly and that you yourself write quite quickly.
There was a writer called Richard Brautigan who I read as growing up and then as an adult. And one of the hallmarks of his style is that his work is extremely crystalline and clear. And it's possible to read his books very rapidly and yet to gain as a gift all that's there.
It's extraordinary you should say that, because my first response to reading your book was, it's as though Brave New World has been rewritten by Richard Brautigan. That was the first writer, honestly, who came to mind.
That's wonderful. So part of it is there are some rules that I try to keep for myself. And I find that if you were to write, I'll give you as an example, collected poems. So I don't like collected poems because I don't believe that the same person wrote all the poems in a book of collected poems. I really feel that we change so much from year to year and from decade to decade that we can be seen to be entirely different people at different times in our lives. And so if that's true, and I believe that it is, then the sense of words, what each person believes that words mean, they're different. And that would be so that in the beginning, in a collected poems book, the first few poems are written by a poet in 1963, and then a few pages later you have some poems in 1971, and a few pages later some poems in 1983. It's very difficult reading a book of collected poems to have a sense of what the author really means, and that's because of the noise, because the words don't mean the same thing, really not at all. In the meantime, between those, the composition of those books, the poet changed and began to feel that certain things. It's not that the words mean completely different things. It's that the weight of all of them has shifted. And so, if you're trying to write about something that's complicated, and yet the stones are shifting under your feet, it's very hard for the reader to understand. This is why I love to read single books of poems as they were composed. So I would rather read all of the poems from 1963 and all of the poems from 1975 or whatever, rather than a collected. So this is the basic knowledge problem that I'm talking about. So if you are to write a novel, and a whole novel, and you want the whole novel to be as clear as possible for the reader, you would want the words to all mean the same thing. Now, if we are, again and again, re-entering this river of life where it's flowing past and everything is changing, the only sort of way to battle against this is to write the book as quickly as possible before the words change and mean something else. So I try to write the book as quickly as possible. This book, A Cure for Suicide, I wrote in Berlin in a week. I usually write from beginning to end, sort of, as you would say, in a breath.
Well, it's been a very productive breath. Jesse Ball, thank you for joining us. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Congratulations. It's a brilliant book.
Thank you so much.
Jesse Ball there. So the book is called A Cure for Suicide. It's published by Text in Australia, and it really is very special. I recommend it so highly. And if you or people you know are dealing with issues around suicide, Lifeline is always there to help. Don't forget that number, 13 11 14. And you know, in Australia, suicide accounts for around a third of all deaths among 14 or 15 to 19 year olds. And on RN this Sunday at 5 p.m, the All in the Mind program is bringing us a new project called Ray of Light, and this connects young people at risk to each other and to the support they need online. And they tell us some very candid stories indeed. That's All in the Mind on RN this coming Sunday at 5 p.m. or any time at all. Of course, on your ABC radio app. On RN, this is Books and Arts.